to Lee Elsie on 94.9 News Now.
All right, welcome back, everyone. So sometimes I get these avalanche or this avalanche of emails, text messages, Twitter posts, what have you, where you got to get this guy on, you got to get this guy on, you've got to get this guy on. And so I was on Gallagher, as you all know, last week, filling in for Mike Gallagher on 400-plus radio stations. And I wish I had tried to reach out to this gentleman to do that show with me, but we can certainly bring him on now to talk about some of the things that are important, certainly important. We've been talking about the FBI and the corruption of the FBI for quite a long while. But joining me right now is Kyle Serafin. And Kyle was a special agent. He's an FBI whistleblower. And, you know, he was on a big interview with Dan Bonadino, and you guys probably got a chance to see that or hear that, and it was really great, and he joins us right now. Kyle, thanks. I appreciate it very much for you coming on today.
Yeah, Lee, I'm happy to be on.
So if you don't mind, before we actually get into it, I really would like to play just a slice of audio, steal it from Dan's show, if you don't mind, and play it for everybody. Just kind of give an idea of where you're coming from, okay?
To go to the Holocaust Museum for a full day when we're in the academy. And they have a special program. I don't know if you've ever been to it, but it's well worth your time. If you're a law enforcement officer, you should definitely go. Everybody that's honest that goes through that museum and looks at all the shoes that still smell like the people that were wearing them, and there's thousands of them in there, it changes your perspective on the entire world. It's looking through the lens of how did this atrocity take place? And the only way it takes place is minor government officials are on board, and local law enforcement, state law enforcement, and federal law enforcement has to say yes. Because if anybody refuses to get with the program, it doesn't happen. And the answer, I'm just following orders, it doesn't fly. We know better. Like, that's the whole point of history. We're supposed to be able to see that. That's why every agent has to go to that day. We're supposed to know that if they ask you to do something that's illegal, immoral, or unethical, following orders is not an excuse. It's not an excuse for me. You can't tell me to go get a vaccine that I'm not going to go get. It goes against my moral principles. I'm not doing it. And I don't want my children to grow up in a world where that's the barrel they're looking down. I don't think that's reasonable. I won't go down that line. You can do whatever comes next. You can ask me to do a search warrant. That's not right. I'm not going to go do it. Because it fundamentally changes the fabric of this country. It changes the game. It puts people in play in the political arena that shouldn't be. Law enforcement shouldn't be in the political arena, number one. And the second piece is we don't go after our former leaders, and we don't go after the opposition leader. That's Banana Republic stuff. Law enforcement has an absolute responsibility to refuse things that are wrong. We can't do it. America is in jeopardy. We can't do it and have America survive the way that we grew up. And I don't want to be part of it.
So that 1 minute and 20-some-odd seconds, 30-some-odd seconds, is dead center bullseye of the way people should think, certainly the way law enforcement people should think. So my number one first opening question, Kyle, to you is why don't they? Why do we have such corruption in the FBI when that simple mantra is should be easy to follow by people who have, you know, good intentions and a good heart?
Yeah, I agree with you. It should be pretty straightforward. I think there's plenty of people in this country that work in law enforcement. I mean, we're talking about close to 1 million sworn officers across the country. And to think that many of them do not have that same instinct and that same sort of ethos, I don't believe that. Because I keep running into good-hearted and good people that do the job. They showed up for the right reason. They have the right attitude about it. There's a couple of complicating factors that I think have allowed us to get to this point. Number one, there's certainly some people that are willing to do things that I think are immoral, illegal, or unethical, and they do those things. But I think they're the minority. There's a bigger chunk of people that are not willing to look around and see what's happening, that they want to bury their head in the sand, they want to go get the paycheck, they want to keep working until they can get that pension. We call it the golden handcuffs. It's the thing that kind of keeps you on the back end. Once you've done 10 years, you might as well do the other 10 years.
Right.
And people in the military are familiar with that same sort of attitude. It's like, I hate what I'm doing. You know, I've moved from doing operational work to go sitting behind a desk. But like, man, I still got a kid and I, you know, who's going to be in college soon. And I got a mortgage and I got a wife that I got to take care of and all these things. So, you know, I think that there's a complicating factor that happens when you start looking beyond the very simple yes, no, black and white. And, you know, for me, I've always said, like, it's a simple path, but it's not easy. And we're living in a world where we're looking down, how do people react? And most people are choosing comfort over, you know, maybe the sort of more difficult path, which is going to leave them in an awkward spot for longer. Right. So I think it's a nuanced question. I'm a Christian. I don't want to judge people. That's not the way that I'm living. And I'm not trying to throw stones at people who are making different decisions, because I don't know what they're, I haven't walked in their shoes.
Right.
But I do know that, you know, I can only make my own decisions. I'll set the example that I've got. I know what I'm going to say, and it's always really easy because it's true, it's accurate, and if people want to follow it, great, and if they choose not to, they've got to answer for their own actions whenever it comes up.
Yeah,
whether it's now or in front of their maker.
You put yourself out there in a very, that's a dangerous situation. You've done what the founding fathers had done, their lives, their fortune, their sacred honor, pledging that to what you think is right. And I do think it's something that's rare nowadays. You say you run into probably a lot more good than bad. I think you're probably right. But then there's that mixture of getting by, getting to the next day, getting your pension, you know, getting your kid to school, all that stuff, right? So that plays a part in it. But still, in the bigger picture, I always equate what we do to those lines that, you know, I pledge my life, my fortune, my sacred honor, all of that. And we don't have a lot of people that are doing that. So kudos to you for doing that and stepping out into the light to announce some of this stuff. So one of the things that we had talked about for the longest time, we being me and the audience, is that there was this sort of sentiment that, well, it's just got to be the top. The rest of the FBI is good. It's got to just be the top that's corrupt. But in that little piece on Bonadio's show, I can't say his name today, on his show, it was that you said that in just walking through the Holocaust Museum, it has to go all the way down to the foot soldiers if it's going to work, right?
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. So it's funny. I think that what happened in 2020 and the follow-on that happened in 2021 really exposed all of this stuff in a way that that I saw, and I have to imagine other people did as well. So I'm going to kind of back that up and say, so what happened in 2020? We saw the BLM riots, the Summer of Love, all that kind of wild stuff. I had a unique position in the FBI, which is not something that people fight to get to. Like, nobody wants to be on the teams that I was on, but it's called the Special Operations Group. And more accurately, it's the Special Observations Group. That's what it really should be called, because we're a surveillance team. And every field office, or most of the field office, rather, have them. And they're a lot of times it's like kind of people that couldn't get along in other ways, and that makes no sense to me because it's a team environment. But that's what they kind of do. That's what it used to be, like really elite right after 9/11. They were falling down all the bad guys and doing the physical surveillance of it. And then they kind of moved to this place where they would just shove people that they didn't really want. And then we kind of brought it back on my team to like really like high speed type operators that really wanted to do the mission of the FBI, which is go see bad guys where they are. Go photograph them in action. It doesn't matter whether they're gang or white collar or you know, child sex traffickers or they were involved in, you know, terrorism activities. That's what we would go do. So we were deployable as a team from the Washington, D.C. area. And I got to see things that most people don't get to see because they're usually just in their own little field office. They don't really go outside of the confines of their, what we call area of operations or AOR. And so, you know, my team went to Portland and I got to spend a couple days in riots out there. We spent 2 weeks investigating Antifa types. No arrest, as you can imagine. I got to see, you know, a little bit from the other teams that were out there that were part of what was going on in Minnesota. You know, we were front and center the day after the Antifa types were burning St. John's Church. So I was at Lafayette Square. You know, the whole team got to see like a lot of really strange stuff that doesn't necessarily fall into every FBI agent's experience. So we got to contrast that with what happened in right after January 6th, which we all know is, you know, it was a riot. There were some, you know, cops that got punched, and people who punched cops, I think they should go to jail. But beyond that, like, if you were waving an American flag inside the velvet ropes, like, I find it atrocious the FBI wants to come after you. So we set that up, and then we saw the mandate coming down with Joe Biden's executive order 14043 saying that you're going to go get these COVID shots, whether you like it or not, regardless of your religious objections. And when that happened, and I told my boss I wasn't going to get them under any circumstances, as you saw in the video, or people heard on the audio of the video, at least. And when I did that, my boss said, look, I agree with you fundamentally, but I can't back you up on this because I've got an alimony that I got to pay an ex-wife, and I got a mortgage right now with my new wife, and, you know, I got to support her, and that's what's going to happen. So I'm going to do that. And that right there is exactly the thing that we know. It's like it goes all the way down. He was a frontline supervisor, GS-14, and a nice guy, like a nice person. I like him as a human being. But professionally, you just sold your honor for like $150,000 or $160,000 a year.
Right.
So that's where it goes all the way to that. And then it goes down to people that were, you know, my colleagues that worked with me have not, like, only one of them has maintained touch with me that's still in the FBI. And there's 14,000 agents. So the people that are out are happy to touch me, but everybody else knows that I'm radioactive because of what I've done.
Right.
And, you know, so what does that tell you about the honor and the integrity of people that work there?
So it's lacking in a big way. And why is it then, does it follow whoever's in charge too? I mean, does it roll to the right if they're Republicans and then lurch to the left if there are Democrats in charge? Or do you feel like it's always been on one side of the aisle in this setup?
So, people have kind of a mistaken view, I think, of the Bureau. When you understand how it works inside, it makes more sense. First of all, it's not a monolith. It's not carved out of stone in one way. I would say overwhelmingly, historically, FBI agents, which I've said, that's 14,000, a little bit less than 14,000 of the 36,000 total employees. So agents tend to lean to the right. And that's the kind of people that believe in law and order. That's the kind of people that are patriotic in the way that you and I probably would agree about. They're the people that serve in the military, that have served as prosecutors and so on. Well, what we're seeing is two things. Number one, two-thirds of the FBI is a intelligence organization that hires intelligence people. And those people are, generally speaking, very educated. They're intelligent, but they believe in different things than I do. And they've spent a lot more time in academia, which has kind of focused them towards the left, leaning sympathies, I'll say, at the very minimum. So you've got two-thirds of the FBI that's going to be at least likely tending towards the left. And then when you talk about people who are professional support, people that are working in supply, people who are working in admin positions, a lot of them need a government job, and they're the type that would normally be government employees, which is generally left-leaning as well. But the agent pool has been shifting because we're requiring less and less experience. When I was going in, you had to have 3 years of professional experience, which means you could get hired at 25. But they also would waive that if you had a professional degree. If you were a lawyer who came right out of law school with no experience, you could roll right into the FBI as an agent. Hmm. And I think that's new. And so we're getting less people in the military. It's probably 30% of my class were military law enforcement background. I think it's lower and lower. And they're also reducing the fitness standards to the point where they're actually going to get rid of them because people aren't even passing them. They're reducing the firearm standards, which should scare the heck out of anybody, to the point where they're willing to do remedial training and give you all these extra abilities. They're trying to recruit more and more women, which women naturally select towards the FBI. And some of the ones that I worked with were absolute killers. And I mean that in a really good way, like right. Deadly shots, could throw a punch, you hit them in the face and they come back for more. Like, I love that. Like, that's my favorite kind of women to work with. But that's less and less common. We're getting more like a lot of lipstick, a lot of makeup, like they care about their appearances. I had a girl in my academy class, this is just a funny anecdote. She put socks into her body armor on the outside of the carrier, like outside of the actual soft armor, so that it looked like she had breasts, like in the armor, to show like body curve. And she was a beautiful girl, like nothing against her. Right. She's a real sweetheart too. But she put those on there, but she doesn't understand body armor, so she put them on the back. Which was even more ridiculous. And then when we're making fun of it, like, your body armor's on backwards. And then she goes, oh, no, I got to stuff the front now. And we're like, no, you don't. Like, you're wearing body armor. Like, no one cares what your body looks like when you're going out and holding a gun in someone's face. They're going to be looking down the barrel of the gun. Like, come on, hon. Like, straighten up.
Right.
Like, be serious. But those are the kind of non-serious people that we're dealing with. And, when you see that at the academy, you go out there and you go, like, I don't know how she votes. It doesn't really matter to me, but she obviously has some different sympathies. She's got some different ideas about what the law enforcement role involves in someone like me. So it is what it is.
Kyle Serafin is our guest. I really can't thank him enough for carving out some time. You can go on Twitter, follow him there. I would definitely do that. Kyle Serafin at Twitter. I guess that's as simple as it can get. So you can check that out. So you mentioned January 6th. Were you there January 6th?
No, I actually have been sending my boss, every boss that I've had since January 6th, a photo of where I was, just in case they ask. Because I was actually on leave, and I was actually out with a bunch of guys from the Maryland, the various Maryland counties that surround the D.C. area. We were doing some training. So most of them were SWAT guys, and we were doing training with handguns and red dots on my own personal dime. And then we hear that the Capitol has been breached, and a lot of these guys had their pagers and their cell phones go off, and they had to respond because D.C. has mutual aid agreements with all the local surrounding counties. So a lot of the guys that I was training with on January 6th itself, halfway into the afternoon, had to leave the class and go in and respond to the Capitol. And, I've said this publicly, and Ryan Riley, who works for NBC, I think, was like trying to, impugn my honor or something. But we were laughing about it because it was funny because they're like, if you remember the day of, like the whole story was chaotic. We were like, what in the hell is happening down there at the Capitol? There's a guy with Viking horns. He's right. Got the gavel. Like things are going sideways. And it looked ridiculous. Like it looked like, idiocracy, from people that were looking on the outside. And then, you start seeing some of the riot scenes. You go, okay, well, that's not really cool. Having been in riots in DC, DC is very good at handling riots. And that one was the worst handled one that I saw in the 5 years that I was stationed there. So, immediately I saw kind of like parallels or maybe not parallels, but contrast on how things were being handled compared to the way that it would normally be handled for that kind of an event. But yeah, luckily I was not there. But you know, just with the grace of God, I had friends who were going to show up, and they had logistical problems, like they couldn't get a ride over or something like that. Like active agents were going to go in and participate in the same thing, go hear the president speak, because it's a totally reasonable thing for you to do.
Sure,
if you live in the United States.
And the thought process from behind most folks is that there was a number of FBI agents embedded to sort of stir up the crowd. Would you agree to that? Believe in that? Is that something that the FBI would do?
Well, I think people use the word agent incorrectly. So here's what my take is on the whole thing. I think that there was no question, and it's been proven out through documents, that the FBI had sources. And we call them confidential human sources, or CHSs, and local police calls them confidential informants. We recruit people like that to get in ahead of certain threats. And there's no question that the FBI had people that were involved in that process that were, CHSs that were in the crowd. But like actual badge and gun carrying agents, that does not strike me as the way the FBI works. I would be shocked. And also, I saw the response after it happened. The days after January 6th, I got pulled into the office with the SWAT team. I wasn't on it. I was a paramedic, so I kind of like supplemented their medical response. And so I sat on my paramedic bag for a couple of days while the guys were telling, their war stories of going into the Capitol. And nowhere in there did I get the impression that anyone had an instinct that this was going to go down the way that it did. And I had friends that were in the command structure, that were in the command post where all the executive management for Washington Field were, and none of them responded like, yeah, this is exactly what we planned. Everybody was scrambling like, what the heck is going on, and how do we deal with this so that it doesn't get any worse. So I don't believe that. That doesn't mean that there wasn't agitators in the crowd that had associations with federal government. I think DHS probably had people there because they have a big intel component. We obviously had people that were CHSs. And the problem with sources, and I've said this to Julie Kelly, who works for American Greatness, sources are infinitely hard to manage. Like, they always have their own motivations, their own ideas, and then they get paid by building cases. Like, that's usually how they get, rewarded for their work. And so if they're money motivated and not patriotic motivated, because I had sources that we paid them nothing. We just never paid anything for them. But there's plenty of people that are doing it for cash, like you saw in the Gretchen Whitmer situation. And so when that happens, those people are motivated by, sort of the ability to drive cases. And so some of them know that what's going to drive a case. So you can't rule out that some of these guys have decided, hey, I'm going to stir this thing up and I'm going to make this a big case and then I'm going to get paid for it. And that's a real scary kind of scenario because they're not supposed to act on their own and do things without permission. But if they happen to do it, it's really, really embarrassing if it comes out. And so the Bureau would probably, Bureau or DHS or any other law enforcement entity, they kind of want to cover for someone that's like pretending to act on their behalf, if that makes sense.
So, you're working for the FBI. They want to give you a shot. Is that the main reason why you jumped ship and said, I've had enough? Or were there other extenuating circumstances behind that that you decided that was it?
Yeah, there's, it was a perfect storm for me. So okay. I went to Las Cruces, New Mexico. I took a voluntary transfer out there. And I was trying to get out of the politics of what the Bureau does. At D.C., it doesn't matter who you work for in D.C. It's inherently political. But I thought, New Mexico is pretty far away. A lot of people don't. They go, is that even in America? I had friends that didn't know where it was. They didn't know if New Mexico was an actual state, that kind of thing. So, you get all that joking, but I'm not sure if some of them weren't serious. So I got out there, and I thought I was kind of like stepping away from everything. I took the job that nobody in the FBI wants, which was working what we call Indian country on the Mescalero Apache Reservation. And so I was literally like volunteered to do like the least national priority job that anybody in the FBI could do, as far as I could tell. And nobody would have fought me for that job, like not a single person in the Bureau.
Right.
And by doing that, I thought I was getting out of the maelstrom. Well, the executive order comes down saying we're going to do COVID shots and everyone's going to get it. I put in a religious exemption right away. I said, look, I'm not doing it, so do whatever happens next. But evaluate my request, I guess. That happened in the end of September of 2021. And then in the middle of October, I had a colleague send me an email that has now become famous because Jim Jordan's office publicized it. But it said that the FBI was going to be looking into parents at school boards with a new threat tag, which was EDU officials. And for people that don't know what a threat tag is, it's essentially like a hashtag that tags intel and data. And so by having that threat tag, it was saying that we were going to be evaluating this type of intelligence for, counterterrorism, intel products and reports going nationally and stuff like that. And so I sent that to my congresswoman right away. On October 27th, I went into her office. I disclosed that. I disclosed some wrongdoings that were going on in the Afghan parolee camp as we had the evacuation that failed. And so we had 20,000 Afghans in our little area of responsibility between Holloman Air Force Base and Fort Bliss. And there were a couple of other things that I had some concerns about. So I brought all those to Congress. And now I'm a whistleblower at that point because I'm alleging a violation of rule, policy, or federal law.
Right.
And, you know, the FBI doesn't do whistleblowers very well. They don't like that very much. And this, unfortunately, there's no actual, like, there's no penalty to the agency if they violate the whistleblower protection law.
Gotcha.
Which is, it is what it is. But that's always been the case, unfortunately.
Kyle Serafin, our guest, again, recovering FBI agent, federal whistleblower, civil liberties enthusiast. He's also got his own a podcast. Now, is your podcast every day?
My podcast is three times a week, give or take. Every day, every Monday, we drop a long-form interview. This has obviously just started in the last couple of days.
So right.
I've maybe got 45 days worth of time under my belt. But I'm interviewing former national security officials who have reached out to me and people that I've connected through the retired agent community. And they're telling stories of being former whistleblowers. They're telling stories of what they saw in the FBI. Some of them are telling me why they retired.
Right.
And they retired very recently because of all the wrongdoing. So I'm trying to give people an inside perspective to folks who wouldn't necessarily talk to a traditional news media organization, because we speak the same language and we solve the same problems. And so we're able to kind of articulate. I'm trying to hone in on exactly what went wrong, how it went wrong, and if there's a way to fix it, which most of us don't agree there is.
Most
people think it needs to be torn down.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to next, if you don't mind. I know we're running short on time here. I've taken a lot of your time, but I wanted to get to that really quick about solutions for the FBI. So right now, we cannot live under this kind of a scenario with the FBI and the CIA, for that matter, and any of the other alphabet soup organizations in Washington. So how do we fix it? Burn it to the ground? Start over? What do you do?
I'm not afraid to burn it to the ground. I think that's not a terrible solution. I just don't think that anybody has the nuts to do so in any sort of legislative process, and I don't think the executive wants to let go of their pitfall. So, it's a real screwy situation. At the very least, the minimum conversation needs to be either removing and destroying the domestic intelligence mission that's been given to the FBI. It doesn't need to exist. I have credible, folks who have run fusion centers, who have spent, decades in intelligence, that tell me that this doesn't need to happen. We're not in the same scenario as 9/11. The real answer to 9/11 might be just that TSA, discomfort that we all go through going into an airline. That may or may not be the case, but I do think that we've mitigated a lot of the threat that we created that domestic intelligence mission after 9/11 for the FBI. So that's part one. It's got to go away. And then we've got to have real whistleblower protections that actually have some teeth. The default position has to be that the agency feels some pain if they decide to do this, because whistleblowers are the only people who really see the inside of the intelligence community, and the intelligence community will go full bore against people like me if we were going to go and say anything about what's going wrong. I found out today that, I put in an allegation that there was a discrimination complaint, and the first thing they did is that the FBI investigates himself on it. So we've got to have a third party that's able to go out and do that, not in the Office of Inspector General, but really something disconnected from DOJ, disconnected from DHS, that goes in and looks at these agencies when there's wrongdoing. And they have to have prosecutorial authority, because if they can't bring a case, and they can't currently, like, people should know that when OIG goes out there and says, we found all this wrongdoing, they bring it back to DOJ, and DOJ goes, thanks so much for that. We're going to let those people retire. We're never going to publicize their name, and they're going to go take big corporate jobs, in a financial company. They're going to go work over at Twitter. They're going to go over and do something, and continue their lives. And the people whose lives they destroyed will not continue the same way. There's no recourse at this point. So it's worth noting, we gotta start doing some third-party checks at the very minimum, but if we have the ability to destroy some of these things and break them down, I think the real question for the American people is, the FBI costs $11.3 billion, or it will, for 2023. Would we use that $11.3 billion to solve the problems that the FBI is now creating and solving? And I don't think the answer is yes. There may be some entity that looks like it, but I don't think the FBI, as it currently stands, is what we would do with our $11 billion, given the choice.
So the term too corrupt to fail is maybe legitimate right now?
I think you're right. Yeah, I haven't heard it exactly put that way, but that's where we're at. There's no question about it that these, everybody insulates themselves.
Right.
And I think that if this this church committee, and there's a possibility that I'm going to be able to play a small role in that and kind of help them shape that that policy, if they don't take a real shot, I mean, there's a guy that I was speaking to yesterday, and he said, when you take a shot at the king, you better not miss.
Right.
And that needs to be the attitude they have. Like, this needs to be an absolutely lethal, direct, and very, very accurate rifle round. It doesn't need to be a shotgun blast saying, here's all the problems. We need to hone in on real, concrete problems with solutions, and we need to hit them so hard that they're actually corrected. Because otherwise, it's just going to get worse.
Kyle Serafin, listen, brother, I appreciate you giving us time, and good stuff. I wish I had more time to talk to you. There's just a million more questions I have to ask you, but maybe down the road. Where can folks, again, find you, and where can they listen to this new show?
Yeah, absolutely. So they can find me on Twitter. It's Kyle Serafin, spelled S like Sierra, E-R-A, P like Papa, H-I-N like November. Kyle Serafin, that's on Truth, Truth Social. It's going to be on Twitter. It's at Kyle Serafin on YouTube, although we've been kind of careful about putting stuff up. Yeah. And then the Rumble channel as well, same thing, / Kyle Serafin. And then if they want to find us, we're on Podbean. It's thekyleserafinshow.podbean.com. They can find us on Apple and Spotify and all that.
All right, man. Keep up the great work. I appreciate you coming on today. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, thanks for the time, Lee.
All right, appreciate man. It. You have a good one. There you go. Kyle Serafin. That was good stuff. And interesting, man. I have a million more questions just scratching the surface with that guy. But maybe we can get him on again down the road. All right, we got to go. We'll come back. Stick around. You're listening to 94.9 News Now and Stimulating
Talk. I've got to find some place to go. I've got to leave, yeah. I've got to find some place to go. Because the way things are happening here now, I don't feel welcome here no more.